You know that again, I don't know what it is.
What about the fat, yeah? The pit and you chop it. Me a drive home, give me some in the traffic. Expensive clothes and now we a cheap fabric. A hot girl, she gets.
Right now, I want to go.
As me reach you.
After hours, right here. Gonna take you right now.
Magnum panic, see the gong.
Enough respect in every answer, can't reach out to all the massive.
Why not?
Watch on this.
Hey, girl. Hey, girl.
The big man in the business.
Hey, girl. Hey, girl. Me can't believe I saw you wicked and tan. Me can't believe I saw you wicked and tan. Yo, I ain't for me, then you bust it like man. My God, I saw you wicked and tan. Me can't believe I saw you wicked and tan. Little girl, I saw you wicked and tan. Yo, I ain't for me, then you bust it like man. My God, I saw you wicked and tan. See your touch, me give pavilion. Your touch, one in a million. Me pretty dive on, see your dive on. Me no blow not a day, no, me no Ivan. If you're married and touch, she's a sin touch. Come for me double touch, she's a twin touch. Pick her up in a the truck, glass tin top. In the back and the seat, still top. Any girl, what love broke it out. Yeah, broke it out, you fi broke it out. Look a princess, you fi wild out. Broke the iron up, get the aisle out. Drop on a high note and sing for me. La la la, sing for me. Come on me yard in a pretty G-string for me. That's a the wildest thing for me. Drop on a high note and sing for me. La la la, sing for me. Come on me yard in a pretty G-string for me. That's a the wildest thing for me. Give me white girl, give me Miss Chin. She said chungla.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to The Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia.
My name's Noah.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today we'll be airing a piece featuring Lucy, Peter Collins' sister. Peter Collins is a longtime contributor to the Prison Radio Show who's currently dying of cancer in a prison in Ontario. The letter his sister will be reading was written by his mother and was published in the Globe and Mail in 1996. We will also be airing a piece by the McGill Law School podcast on the mandatory victim surcharge, as well as excerpts from the documentary Free World Pens by Nika Kanjani. But first, here are a few news headlines.
The Ontario government announced it is launching a review of the solitary confinement policy in provincial jails, which house those awaiting trial or who are serving terms of less than 2 years. Inmates serving 2 years or more are held in federal prisons. The news came in a statement issued on March 26th from Ontario's Ministry of Community Safety and Correctional Services. The statement said the, quote, comprehensive review of the segregational policy and its use in provincial jails will focus on how it interacts with the ministry's other other mental health policies. On any given day, nearly 8,000 individuals are in custody in one of Ontario's 26 institutions. About 5% of those inmates are in segregation. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Stephen Harper's Conservative government has rejected widespread calls to limit solitary confinement in federal prisons. The federal government last December dismissed the over 100 recommendations stemming from the inquest into Ashley Smith's 2007 death in solitary confinement. According to the Ontario provincial government, consultations for their segregation policy review will begin as early as this summer.
Democracy Now! Reports that imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal has been transferred back to prison after he was taken to the intensive care unit at Schuylkill Medical Center in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, following a blackout from diabetic shock. Abu-Jamal's supporters said he was kept under heavy guard and isolated from visitors in the hospital. Abu-Jamal has been moved back to the infirmary at SCI Mahanoy Prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania, where he again was not allowed visitors. His supporters rallied at the prison on Friday to demand he be allowed to receive medical care from doctors outside the facility. They say authorities may have withheld from Abu-Jamal details about blood tests that could have indicated he was suffering from diabetes.
Last week, 78 incarcerated mothers at GEO Group's Karnes County Detention Center in Texas signed a letter announcing a hunger and work strike and to demand their immediate release. The letter, in part, reads, quote, "During this time, no mother will work in the detention center, nor will we send our children to school, nor will we use any services here until we are heard and approved. We want our freedom." Unquote. According to Colorlines.com, who obtained a copy of the letter, most of the 78 incarcerated mothers have brought their children from Guatemala and El Salvador, countries with some of the highest femicide rates on the planet. The Huffington Post now reports that some of those mothers were put in solitary confinement with their children in response to the protest.
Hunger strikers at Ohio State Penitentiary are still at it this week. According to LucasvilleAmnesty.org, Siddique Abdullah Hassan reported that the hunger strikers were able to meet with the top staff at OSP on April 4th. At the time, there were 8 men on hunger strike. Their two main demands regard recent policy shifts on range recreation and access to religious programming. As of Tuesday, April 7th, 3 hunger strikers are facing serious medical conditions, and one of them has stopped his hunger strike, while the others are reportedly continuing to hunger strike in the medical department of OSP. As regular listeners know, prisoner Peter Collins is currently serving his 32nd year of a 25 years to life sentence, and he's currently dying of bladder cancer in prison and is expected to live only months. Despite the fact that Peter has had no internal charges for the last 20-plus years in Canada's federal prison system, he has been denied parole over and over again. He has been at Bath Medium Security Federal Prison for about half of his incarceration, and he remains there today. Peter was recently denied parole again on February 15th, and this decision is now under appeal. You can see the Ottawa Citizen for more details about that decision. If you want to help with Peter Collins' request for compassionate release, you can go to either of the following websites, www.chrisblebedev.com, and then search for Peter Collins, or look for the Peter Collins Support Committee on Facebook. What you're about to listen to is a letter that Peter's mom, Joan Stoddard, wrote to the Globe and Mail in 1995, but was only printed in 1996, posthumously. This letter is being read by Peter's sister, Lucy Collins. Although this letter represents a mother's point of view from close to 2 decades ago, it still rings true for family members who have loved ones in prison today.
Okay, my name is Lucy Collins. I'm Peter Collins's sister. And I'm about to read an article that our mother, Joan Stothard, wrote for the Globe and Mail It was published posthumously. My mom died on October 26, 1995. This little article was published Thursday, March 21st, 1996. There is only one penalty provided for first-degree murder, and that is imprisonment for life without eligibility for parole for 25 years, and you are sentenced to that. The judge was addressing my son, but in reality he was condemning our entire family, handcuffed as we were by our love for Peter. It was September 19th, 1984. A friend was waiting for me when I got home on October 14th, 1983. She told me the police were looking for Peter as a suspect in the shooting death of a policeman, Constable David Utman. I watched the news in horror, seeing my son coming out of a house with no shirt on and his hands over his head, several officers' guns trained on him. My mind reeled from this horror to the other. Two little boys had lost their father through the violent, senseless action of one of my children. And my sadness spreads, taking in not only that family and Peter, but also my other children as they struggle to balance their right to be morally and emotionally unencumbered by Peter's situation with their desire and need to be there for him. We have received loving support from our families in England, but there are ramifications. We chose not to tell Peter's grandparents about his crime, and they died without knowing. Now, as he serves the 12th year of his sentence, I am tired. There has been too much invalidated grief, too much guilt, love, resentment, too much vacillation between a determination to be strong and giving in to defeatism, too much empathy and anguish, horror, stress, fear, and loneliness. At the beginning of the sentence, I was numb, shocked with horror both at the crime he had committed and how he was going to pay for it. I felt that my skull could not contain the pressure of my feelings. I have never felt satisfied with my efforts to support him. I have felt guilty for not visiting enough, feeling too tired and reluctant to spend precious, needed days off work driving to the special handling unit at Saint-Anne-des-Plaines, to Millhaven Penitentiary, or to Joyceville. Often feeling resentful when I do go, always feeling guilty when I don't. Hating to be in the wretched prison, loathing the place, the atmosphere, the guards, the barbed wire, the electronically locked and unlocked doors and gates, the sensitized ground between the fences, the signing in, the searches. I feel guilty that I can find 2 hours almost unbearably claustrophobic when I know that this visit is Peter's only relief from the stultifying boredom of his sentence. I feel relief and gratitude if it's a good visit, that is, Peter's mood is relatively up, but it is unbearable to endure those times when I can find no way to ease the dead weight of his pain. I have often felt anger, usually suppressed, and resentment when I've gone all that way and he won't or cannot do his part to make the visit work. On one level, I think, why should he be expected to rise to the occasion accepting the magnanimity of our visit, made when it's convenient, when it can be squeezed in, when the roads are not too icy, when we think we can handle it, when guilt has been the impetus? But on another level, I think, damn it, I have come to this wretched place with its ghastly surveillance towers, 10-meter-tall fences with razor-sharp wire on top, guards who are at once frightening and contemptible, and correctional vans circling the prison grounds like flies around rotten meat. Physically and emotionally, the cost has been high. For me, sleeplessness, migraine, deep fatigue, depression, utter joylessness. For Peter, times of deep anguish that he has had to endure alone. While he has been in prison, his grandparents died, his older brother had cancer, recovering happily after a rough time of surgery and chemotherapy. His younger brother died in a motorbike accident. He has seen our family become almost totally fragmented, and his own short marriage to a volunteer visitor ends in divorce. And now I have inoperable cancer. These are heavy emotional crises under any circumstances, but must be a nightmare to endure alone in prison, and I feel so hurt for him and worried about how much sadness he can take. Horrific incidents happen in prison that are given minimal coverage in the press. Before Peter went to prison, events such as these would have reduced me to tears, preyed on my mind, kept me awake feeling upset, horrified, impotent, and outraged. Now, after more than 11 years, I seem to have become desensitized to a large extent to the most hideous events. Rapes, assaults, murders, and suicides. I accept as normal great injustices, lies, platitudes, and indifference. The prison visitor's experience is one of demeaning, demoralizing, barely veiled contempt. It starts with the guard's hostility, but we are also exposed to the unhappiness of other prisoners and their visitors, children, parents, grandparents, friends, wives, girlfriends. The visiting rooms are sticky, mucky places. I feel especially sorry for the children who must endure an hours-long visit in a very crowded room with stressed, frustrated parents. Many are tired from a long, inconvenient journey, and when they arrive, the few toys that are available are in poor shape, torn, broken, or incomplete. It sends these children a strong message. If your dad is in prison, this is what you get to play with. Recently, I was driven by a friend to Millhaven to let Peter know of major surgery I was to have later that week. As he had been placed in isolation where he was kept for more than 4 months, all allegations against him were eventually proven groundless. We had to have a closed visit, that is, Peter behind glass and me in a narrow, noisy, tense corridor of cubicles with 7 or 8 other visitors all having to talk into tiny, low openings in the glass. The visits officially last 2.5 hours, but I was told to leave after 20 minutes as there were too many visitors that day. When I explained to the guard that I hadn't yet told Peter about the surgery, that I needed more time, his bored reply was, "Everybody has their own reason." He was very careful not to look me in the eye as he said this. He was ashamed, but hardened to being ashamed. I am sure that our family is not unique in its utter lack of importance to officials at Correctional Service Canada. To me, this lack of accountability to us is frightening and absolutely unacceptable. CSC seems not to differentiate between prisoners and prisoners' families. Strong family ties are crucial to a prisoner's adjustment to his sentence and to his life after release. We know this, and so does the CSC. As a mother, my experience is that this sentence is vengeful, useless, destructive, hope-sapping. Peter's release is remote. He has bleak, useless, destructive years ahead of him. Yet I have seen him try to improve and transcend his situation. I love to see any evidence of this. It makes me feel hopeful and relieved. I relax for a while from the relentless necessity of trying to keep him focused on the future. I marvel at his ability to withstand gross violations to his sense of self, the endless, mindless, petty cruelties and irritations. I would prefer to end this essay on a positive note, but right now I can't see one. A life sentence is abhorrently merciless. It means that our society believes that the accused cannot repent enough, cannot become more stable or more loving, cannot benefit from the grace of God. It condemns the prisoner and his family to a lifetime of longing and grief. The dull hopelessness I see in the eyes of many prisoners, including Peter, is to me a manifestation of the evil of the justice system. Rehabilitation, if it ever happens, is a miracle. This is no comfort to me as a mother, and I rage against the obscenely expensive, archaically inhumane and useless, faceless system we have devised, and which most people do not want to know about. The entrance to Millhaven is paved with neat, pretty flower beds. I hate these flower beds. Just a few feet away are vile isolation cells, pipes down which gas can be sent to quell any disturbance, towers from which prisoners can be shot, great suffering and fear, destructive boredom, obscene power, and hopelessness, all hidden and trivialized, disguised by colorful bursts of life itself.
You were listening to a letter written by prisoner Peter Collins' mother, Joan Stothard, and it was being read by Peter's sister, Lucy Collins. The letter was published in the Globe and Mail in 1996, posthumously. To know more about Peter Collins, you can visit either the Peter Collins Support Committee on Facebook or chrisblebedeb.com and then search for Peter Collins. The time is currently 5:22 p.m. and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM.
This April, If You Got Ears will take you for a walk down Montreal's best-kept secret streets. This month, Marcus Lake will be interviewing the founders of some of Montreal's best alternative venues. Tune in every Wednesday in April from 12 to 2 p.m. to listen to everything from rap to electroacoustics and hear from the people behind your favorite underground show spaces. If You Got Ears on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca. Listen.
Up next is a piece by McGill Law students about the mandatory victim surcharge. The piece comes to us from an old Prison Radio Show correspondent, C. Strauss.
Making the victim surcharge mandatory is the latest conservative tough-on-crime measure to come under fire in the courts and in the media.
Welcome to the McGill Law Journal podcast. I'm Sam Greg Wallace.
And I'm C. Strauss. The victim surcharge was first enacted in 1988. That legislation mandated that any person sentenced for a crime must also pay a surcharge in addition to any other sentence. The money, as the title of the surcharge suggests, is earmarked for victim services, which are administered by the provinces. Although judges were supposed to impose the surcharge automatically, they routinely waived it, often with very little explanation. On many occasions, they believed that a term of imprisonment and/or a fine was a sufficient sentence and in accordance with long-standing principles of sentencing, and so, imposing a surcharge would be unnecessary additional punishment.
In 2013, the government passed Bill C-37, entitled the Increasing Offenders Accountability for Victims Act. This act doubled the surcharge so that the amount to be imposed is now $100 or $200 for each count, depending on the severity of the offense, or 30% in the case of a fine. The act also removed the discretion that judges previously had to impose the fine or not. Lastly, it amended the criminal code to allow for fine option programs, so that if someone can't pay the fine, they can enter a work program to pay off the amount owed rather than being sent to jail.
Some judges bristled at the revocation of their discretion and found ways to circumvent the new legislation. So in July of 2014, Judge Pasioko in Ottawa made waves when he found that in cases where a fine couldn't be levied and a person was facing multiple counts, the surcharge amounted to a charter breach, that of cruel and unusual punishment. Since then, Ontario's judiciary has been split, with some judges following Judge Pasioko's decision and others pointedly departing from it.
Here in Montreal, Justice Healy was one of the first to refuse to impose the surcharge. In the case, R.V. Cloud, the accused was an Aboriginal man whose circumstances, in the words of Justice Healy, constituted a tragic cycle of poverty, homelessness, violence, and addiction. In this case, which is currently on appeal, Justice Healy found that the surcharge would amount to a disproportionate, unfit, and unjust sentence. Rather than finding that the surcharge amounted to cruel and unusual punishment, as Pasioko did, Justice Healy refused to impose the surcharge based on a more technical point of law.
On that technical point, there is a rule in sentencing that fines can only be given in cases where the person being convicted doesn't also receive a jail sentence. Justice Healy found that because the surcharge is in fact by definition a fine, Parliament has opened the door to the concurrent imposition of both. So he imposed a $5 fine in addition to Mr. Cloud's probation and jail time, allowing the amount of the surcharge to be calculated as a percentage of the fine. Mr. Cloud was required to pay only a $3 surcharge instead of $400 that would have been applied had a fine not been imposed.
The issue of the victim surcharge has now become politically charged and strikes at the core of the balance of power between the legislature and the judiciary.
In this podcast, we will explore the function and purpose of a victim surcharge, the rationale behind making it mandatory, and the ways that some judges have resisted the changes. We'll explore the position of victims' rights advocate Sue O'Sullivan and hear from Kim Pate, the executive director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, on the effect this surcharge has on people convicted of crimes. Finally, we'll ask whether the rights of those who have been victimized must necessarily be opposed to the rights of the criminalized.
We sat down with Sue O'Sullivan, the federal ombudsman for victims of crime.
Hi, thanks for joining us today, Sue.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity.
So today we're talking about the mandatory victim surcharge. And to frame our conversation, could you give us a bit of a background about what a victim surcharge is?
Yes, certainly. So what is a surcharge? It is monies that is gathered that the offender pays as a result, as part of, because as you know, part of the sentencing principles are accountability, responsibility on the part of the offender, and reparation of harm. So this money is why it's so important that it's gathered, is this money is intended, it goes to the provinces and territories to fund victims' programs. And as you can imagine, each province and territory has their own individual decision on what their needs are in terms of programming. But just for your audience, I mean, some simple things like, to fund counseling, to have victim support assistance when going to court, to conduct safety planning for victims. These are all core services that victims of crime require. And, of course, they have to be funded.
So the Conservative government passed Bill C-37. Mm-hmm. That was a short bill, only 6 pages. But it has a significant impact. What has changed since 1998 or since the surcharge was initially introduced in the 80s? What changed in Bill C-37?
So there's really three things that changed. And obviously, we can get into the play on words, but the victim surcharge was automatic. Now it's mandatory. So a judge must impose. The second thing that changed, and I think is a hugely important thing, is it amended the criminal code to allow the fine option programs at the provinces and territories to be used by offenders if they are not able to pay, that they can enter into the fine option program. And thirdly, it doubled the surcharge. So if you were convicted of a lesser offense, or in legal terms it's called a summary offense, you would be ordered to pay $100. If in fact it was a more serious offense, or in legal terms indictable offense, you'd be ordered to pay $200. But they also have the ability to impose a fine. And so whatever the judge deems an appropriate fine, 30% of that fine that the judge imposes on you at time of sentencing would go to a surcharge.
Generally speaking, what's the rationale for a victim surcharge?
So it's an important part of ensuring that the victims, because, and I thank you for asking that question, because I think so many times when we start talking about, I'll say, offender management issues, we lose sight of the cost of crime to victims. And quite frankly, in our country, and there was a study done by the Department of Justice, which says that both tangible and intangible, 83% of the cost in crime in this country is borne by victims. And quite frankly, that's unacceptable. And so when you look at the burden that they're carrying, and, we talk about impact to people, when you talk about the impact of victimization, they have issues, concurrent issues that might come with, as your listeners would expect, that come with victimization. They're going to need counseling. They're going to need supports. So the monies that is raised by this is absolutely, so important to be able to ensure that there is some funding available, at that local level to be able to assist victims. So part of the thinking behind that really is also not just about meeting the needs of victims, but it is about accountability and it is about reparation of harm by offenders and accountability for the crimes that they have committed.
Next, we spoke to Kim Pate, the executive director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies. The Elizabeth Fry Society works with and for women and girls in the justice system, particularly those who are or may be criminalized. Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
So to frame our conversation, could you tell us what a victim surcharge is and the role it has played at law in Canada?
Sure. A victim surcharge was introduced as part of the move in the last couple of decades to recognize that the role of victims in the system has long been ignored. One of the reasons the victim surcharge was set up was ostensibly to provide resources for people who have been victimized so that there would be services put in place funded by the very individuals who are convicted of breaching the law, and to help basically provide ways for victims to be compensated. The reality is, though, since the victim surcharge system has been set up, is we know that the majority of the resources are not in fact used for victims at all, but tend to go to fund system-based services, police-based services. And so the recent changes to make victim surcharges mandatory were really because there was a presumption or a perception that, in fact, people weren't contributing sufficiently, when, in fact, there had never been a full audit of what the victim surcharge monies that were being collected were being used for. Most of it just went into the administration, Criminal Justice Administration. In terms of the criminal law, the surcharge was supposed to be a way to provide a mandatory requirement that those who have been convicted of criminal offenses contribute to supports for victims by imposing a fine essentially on them that is called a victim surcharge, that is supposed to go directly to services for victims as a way essentially for victims to be compensated, if you will, or for people who have been convicted of criminal offenses to be accountable to victims. The reality is, though, that sounds appealing to many people in principle. It's not, in fact, how it applies, and it ignores the reality that the majority of the people who come under the gaze of the criminal justice system, who are the easiest to catch, are usually those who are most surveilled, and those are people who are already the most marginalized, often the most victimized, therefore more likely to be criminalized and institutionalized. And so we're talking about people, fundamentally, most of whom are poor. So imposing a fine surcharge or a victim surcharge on individuals who are already impoverished as a way to hold them accountable means that the only way they are going to be able to pay that surcharge is likely by doing something else for which they will likely be criminalized. And so it becomes a horrible, vicious cycle, a tautological argument, if you will, for accountability, which is not just tautological, it's fallacious. Instead, if we had, for instance, resources put in place to ensure adequate social services, health care, educational supports for all people, we would likely see two things: fewer people being victimized, fewer people being marginalized, therefore fewer people being resorting to behaviors that could cause them to be criminalized or cause them to harm other people.
Now, in terms of what changed in 2013, most people focus on the fact that with the mandatory nature of the surcharge in place, those who can't pay the fine may be jailed for their inability to do so, which would be an unintended further punishment of society's most marginalized. O'Sullivan clarifies that this need not be the outcome of the surcharge.
People often talk, what if people can't pay, and about the undue hardship around that. But the reality is, you know, there's only three provinces that don't have a fine option program, which could be as simple as, if you can't afford to pay the fine, then you can do volunteer and community work. So one of our recommendations is to continue to encourage the federal government to have the conversation with the three provinces that don't have the fine option program, because that's an obvious solution that's going to allow people who, as a result of not having financial means, to still be accountable and held accountable.
Given that Pate has been quite vocal on the perils of people being sent to jail by virtue of defaulting on the surcharge, we asked her about the fine option programs as well.
Not every province and territory provides that option, however, and it was unclear to us, and certainly remains unclear, as to whether a victim surcharge would fit in that category. And if, in fact, it did, two problems arise. One is it's a victim surcharge. It's not a fine. So it was not the penalty, if you will, for the criminal conviction. And the justification the government provided for the victim surcharge was it was to provide resources to victims. If you then have to set up a government program to allow people to pay off the victim surcharge, one, is any resource actually going to the victim? And two, is it not just costing more for the government to create a new program or to adjust to an existing program to allow people to pay off the victim surcharge? Will, you know, where is there any evidence that that will result in more resources for victims? And I think it would very clearly reveal just the opposite, that it would likely result in the need for the government, for various governments, provincial and territorial, to set up yet again new programs to allow individuals to perform community service work to then not be jailed for not paying the victim surcharge.
Everyone can agree on the need to fund victim services. The question, however, is who should bear that cost? Another more fundamental question that arises is whether one can really distinguish, beyond a rhetorical level, between victims and criminals in the way that the criminal justice system has encouraged us to do. We put that question to Kim Pate.
I think that the people who are most in need, both who are victims and who have been criminalized in the criminal justice system, often come from the same groups. They tend to be those who are most marginalized, those who already don't have a lot of supports in place in the community, as well as financial supports, and for whom we need many other resources in place. It doesn't mean that behavior that harms others is in any way something we want to justify or not try and address and prevent. But to pretend that these sorts of measures, like a victim surcharge, will do either of those things is, well, as I say, I think it's a bit cynical and certainly unrealistic if people don't intend it to be cynical.
Breaking down the victim-criminal dichotomy is an important topic for discussion, and it's something that we wanted to raise in this podcast. But it's not the issue that has ruffled the feathers of the courts. We asked Kim Pate to explain why some judges have been refusing to impose the surcharge, and about her reaction to this.
The cases where judges refused to impose the victim surcharge were predominantly cases of individuals who were indigent, who already had no money, for whom we've already had cases that have gone to superior courts, appeals that have gone to superior courts, where judges in the past have imposed fines against individuals who clearly could not pay the fine. So it was really giving people a jail sentence through the back door. Where to impose on victim surcharge would place an undue hardship on a man or a woman or a young person who was convicted of an offense. The argument is that the judge should refuse to impose that and should maintain his or her judicial independence and allow the person not to have to pay the victim surcharge. And certainly those cases are now under appeal. It will be interesting to see what the various provincial and territorial courts of appeal do. And ultimately, we will likely see this go to the Supreme Court of Canada.
Though Pate focuses on the political consequences of the surcharge and the role of the judge in sentencing, others speculate that the judiciary might be responding so strongly not to the change in law, but to the restriction of their exercise of discretion. O'Sullivan regrets this restriction, but points out that when the judges did have that discretion available to them, they never applied the surcharge.
What I can say is this, there was a study done in New Brunswick, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Basically, it was a five-year study that looked at the federal victim surcharge. And what they found is in two-thirds of the cases, the victim surcharge was being waived. It wasn't being applied. Not only was it not being applied in two-thirds of the cases, they're being waived. When they looked at 861 cases and looked for the rationale as to why they were waived, which courts are supposed to document, in 99% of those cases they looked at, there was no reason given for the waive. So what we do know is it wasn't working. I mean, it was not doing what it was supposed to do in the courts, if you will, were routinely waiving these. And so I think part of this is to ensure that the system that wasn't working, that we start to bring about some consistency to ensuring that as this is applied across the country for doing that, and as well, again, those principles of sentencing, of accountability and reparation of harm.
So see, we've tried to give an introduction of the surcharge and what's at stake when judges decide to impose it or refuse to do so. We've presented our listeners with two well-founded and well-formed expert opinions. Now, it's up to them.
Thanks for tuning in to the McGill Law Journal podcast. Today's episode was produced by Sam Greg Wallace. Thanks to Sue O'Sullivan and Kim Pate for joining us today. and a special thanks to David Nugent, who provided the music. Visit us on our website at lawjournal.mcgill.ca. Better yet, follow us on Twitter at McGill_LJ and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes.
That was a piece by former Prison Radio Show correspondent C. Strauss, who's currently studying law at McGill. As C. said at the end of the podcast, for more information on the podcast, those of you with the internet can check out the McGill Law Journal podcast on iTunes and also their website. Up next, we have a piece by Nika Kanjani. It's Free World Pens, which is a documentary. Nika's brother has been in administrative segregation for the last 4 years. He's been in prison for almost 9. Nika visits him at least once a year, but the trip to West Texas from Montreal is not easy. Free World Pens is a documentary Nika made with images of Montreal and audio of her reading letters sent back and forth between her and her brother. And we bring you some excerpts from the documentary now.
September 21st, 2006. Hi, love. I'm doing all right this week. It's been so hot here. There's no air conditioning, and it's making everyone more aggravated than usual. That's not a good thing in this place. But I'm cooling off when I can, even if it's with a small pail of water. I got your photos. I can't believe how long your hair is. Don't worry about the gray hairs. I'm getting them too. I counted 12 in my beard the other day. It's been another long month. The days haven't changed much since the last time I wrote you. You wanted to know about my sleep, what I dream about. I usually can't remember if I have any dreams, but I did try to remember since you asked. I had one where I was back at work at the fish market. The delivery truck was out back, and when I went to grab the crates, the fish were iridescent and still alive. The whole back of the truck was an aquarium, and it was beautiful. At one point, I fell in. I was swimming. April 12th, 2007. Hello, love. Where are you? Did you get my last letters? I haven't heard from you in a while. Please let me know that you're doing okay. The last letter I got from you, you were having a hard time. The winter was long, and you weren't going out much. Please go out. See people. Do things. Describe them to me. I was listening for you tonight on the radio, but maybe you didn't get through. Did Dad tell you that he came up to visit last weekend? The visit was good for both of us. We left and caught up. I'm sorry about the bitter tone of my last few letters. Things feel hard these days, but don't worry, I'm all right. March 2nd, 2008. I'm in a new place. I don't know for how long. Like you, I have a window. There's no church or market or schoolyard outside of mine, but the sun does shine through, and I can see the sky and clouds when I lie down. The rumor is that this facility will be shut down soon and turned into a historical building. It's been around for over a century. It was used to house slaves. No shit. On my right is the factory where they make all the cheap blue soap that we use in this region. Above and behind the soap factory are some beautiful trees. And if you look toward the sky, there's a rusty off-white water tower with a blue star on it. November 12th, 2009. Hi, sweetheart. I'm sorry to hear about the breakup. What can I say? I know you loved him, and I know he loved you too. How could he not? But try not to dwell on it, and please try not to call him for a while. Don't worry about me so much. I'm not in any danger. There are some good guys around me. Mostly I don't see anyone at all. Did you get the picture I sent you? He didn't say anything about it. It's not the best shot of me, I know, but it's the best we could do. Do I look different? Does my skin look gray? Do you think you'd recognize me if you saw me on the street? Nika, what am I doing here? What am I doing here? What am I still doing here? July 10th, 2011. I wish there was more I could tell you, but it's more of the same. I'm trying to transition back into sleeping nights and staying awake in the day so I can get outside for that 1 hour that I'm given. I slept through it yesterday. I'll keep this short. As you can see, my pen is running out of ink. I got a card from Mom. She seems to be doing okay. Says she's gonna visit you. Hey, don't be nervous about telling me that you're having a good time, or about your travel plans. Of course, I'm not jealous of that. I want you to be happy, to live your life. You know that. Remember that guy Rizio I told you about? The guy that yodels? Well, he's across from me, and he yells nonstop at everyone. The other day, he threw a cup of his own piss at a guard. He didn't get fed for 5 days. I think he's used to it. He doesn't really eat anymore. When someone gets into trouble, they get put on a food loaf. Whatever is on the food tray is thrown in a mixer and then put in the oven. It's terrible. March 10th, 2013. I just turned 29. Yes, I'm still in solitary. This time for 24 hours a day. Maybe once a week I get to go outside for an hour. They told me at my next 6 month review that I have a good chance of being moved out of ADSEG and into general population, since I haven't had a case in a long time. In the meantime, I'm functioning. I keep reading and I keep writing to keep the time passing. They still haven't given me a reason why I'm here, except something about contraband on my file. But that was in 2008 that I caught that case, and it was for a couple of Free World pens. That's it. June 4th, 2013. Where to begin? It's 8:15 p.m. We just got off a 5-week lockdown, and the whole block has been starving. It's funny because it's dead quiet in here these days from about 6 p.m. to breakfast at 3:30 a.m. because everyone is too hungry to talk. So we all just drink a lot of water and lay it down, waiting for 3 a.m. Some of these cats will fill up on coffee and sugar to keep them going all night and day. That's when the earplugs become a godsend. You asked me to describe my cell. It's about 10 by 13 feet of walking space. The door has a slim panel of plexiglass with a view of the block. I hear people talking, but I can't see their faces. I keep my radio on to block out the noise, and I use my earplugs when that doesn't work. I cover the lights with sheets. These fluorescent lights are so bad for the eyes. Don't worry about me. I'll take my multivitamins when they're in stock. I'm doing okay. I'll be okay. I'll close this now so I can send it off to you. I love you. I love you. I love you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. For everything that you do.
Those were excerpts from the documentary Free World Pens by Nika Kanjani, featuring letters between her and her brother, who is currently incarcerated in Texas. The Prison Radio Show spoke recently with Nika, and that interview will be airing in the coming months, so stay tuned. The time is presently 5:51 p.m., and you're listening to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
Something saying,
well, don't you know?
That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying,
well, don't you know?
That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they work so hard till the sun is going down. Working on the highways and byways and wearing a frown. You hear them moaning their lives away. Then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. Can't you hear them saying, I'm going home one of these days. I'm going home, see my woman whom I love so dear. But meanwhile, I've got to work right here. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, my, 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 my. My work is so hard, give me water, I'm thirsty, my. My work is so hard, oh, oh, my, 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 my.
My work is so hard.
That was the song Chain Gang by Sam Cooke. And we apologize for the loud noise and gunshots you heard there earlier. We were trying to bring you another song, but having technical difficulties. The time is currently 5:55, and you've been listening to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. To check out past episodes of The Prison Radio Show, you can go to prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Prison Radio Show. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Friday, April 24th at 11 a.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, please feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for tuning into The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name's Noah.
And my name is Virginia.
And we've been your hosts for today. Please stay tuned.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Wherever you are, it's somewhere walking straight for you.
Critics are calling It Follows one of the scariest movies ever.
It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd.
Terrifying, shocking, and impossible to shake off.
Whatever helps it get close to you.
Don't watch this alone. It doesn't think. It doesn't feel. It doesn't give up. It follows.